Chapter 15. London, Satan's Throne. I am a god. In the seat of God I have seated myself, in the heart of the open sea. Ezekiel 28:2. Just as all the nations of the earth are likened to symbolic trees planted in the Garden of Eden, Jehovah's forest of tree-like nations has an appointed overseer, as did Eden originally. The overseer of nations in Ezekiel's prophecy is the king of Tyre, of whom Ezekiel 28:13 and 14 says, "In Eden, the garden of God, you prove to be. You are the anointed cherub that is covering." While it is evident that Jehovah was referring to Satan the devil before his rebellion, why does God link the king of Tyre with the anointed cherub of Eden? The answer has to do with the fact that the real rulers of our world are not human at all. Jesus and his enlightened apostles revealed that wicked spirits in heavenly places are the real authorities and principalities that dominate this wicked system of things. It is only logical, then, that any judgment against the spirit rulers in the invisible realm would also become manifest upon the earthly powers under their control. That is why Jehovah's judicial decision expressed against the king of Tyre is intertwined with the judgment against the evil spirit creature now known as Satan the devil. But what relevance could this ancient prophecy possibly have today? Although God's judgments against the maritime empire of Tyre were fulfilled long ago, the prophecies apply in amazing detail to the British Empire and the modern city of London in particular. Since the devil and his demons were not judged at the time that Babylon or Alexander the Great destroyed Tyre, it is apparent that the prophecies against Tyre have a much grander fulfillment related to Jehovah's forthcoming judgments against the entire wicked system of things, both heavenly and earthly. In the 27th chapter of Ezekiel, the prophet is commanded to compose a dirge for the passing of Tyre. The opening words of the dirge say of Tyre, "O you who are dwelling at the entrances of the sea, the tradeswoman of the peoples for many lands." The Phoenician coastal city of Tyre is recorded in history as dominating the Mediterranean Sea with her fleet of merchant ships, even plying the waters of the North and South Atlantic. Yet the description of Tyre as one dwelling at the entrances of the sea applies even more especially to London's British Empire. During the days of the formal empire, she controlled virtually every major waterway in the entire world. This was vital in view of the fact that London's empire was a maritime empire. One of the most important entrances of the sea is the natural sea gate through the Straits of Gibraltar. The Straits of Gibraltar are, of course, the vital entryway connecting the Atlantic Ocean and the Mediterranean Sea. Interestingly, the Phoenicians and Tyrians once held that sea gate too, and for the last several centuries it has been a British-held fortress. Gibraltar was a strategic British asset during both world wars. The Suez Canal is another vital waterway that makes it possible to travel from the Indian Ocean through the Red Sea and into the Mediterranean Sea without looping all the way around Africa. It was particularly vital for British imperial interests to control the Gibraltar and Suez sea gates because that allowed Britain more direct access to her most important colony at that time, India. By 1900, British naval bases were maintained around the world at strategic choke points, which gave London a presence on virtually every major sea lane on the planet. For example, since around 1860, The Royal Navy's Pacific Fleet has been harbored at Esquimalt, British Columbia. On the Atlantic side of the Western Hemisphere, a British naval presence was maintained in Halifax, Nova Scotia, as well as Bermuda and Jamaica and St. Lucia. On the opposite side of the Atlantic, the Royal Navy was based at Gibraltar and Freetown in the African colony of Sierra Leone. From 1814, after wresting control from the Dutch colonists, the British established a naval presence at Cape Town, South Africa, which allowed them to control the shipping lanes around the southern tip of Africa. On the east side of Africa, at the turn of the 20th century, the Royal Navy was harbored at Mombasa, Kenya. Other critical choke points included Aden in Yemen, which was at the entryway of the southern end of the Red Sea, where it joins the Indian Ocean. From bases in Bombay, Ceylon, Singapore, Hong Kong, and Sydney, Britain controlled the vital waterways of the Indian subcontinent and the entire Orient, as well as the sea lanes of the countless islands of the South Pacific. Unquestionably, Great Britain once sat at the entrances of the sea, and to a great extent, it still does. But besides controlling crucial shipping lanes, sea gates, and other vital infrastructure, the Crown maintains a virtual empire composed of dozens of islands scattered across the seven seas of the globe. Anguilla and Barbuda, Bermuda, the Falklands, British Virgin Islands, Jamaica, the Solomon Islands, St. Helena, and the Cayman Islands, to name a few. Of these, the Cayman Islands appear to be the most important, serving as a virtual modern-day pirate cove for offshore drug money laundering, tax evasion, and other illegal operations, which are carried out through the thousands of hedge funds registered there. As of 2007, of the nearly 10,000 hedge funds in the world, over 8,000 are registered to the Cayman Islands. For an island grouping with a total population of less than 60,000, that means that there is one hedge fund for every 7.5 people on the islands. Truly, to whatever extent Tyre may have colonized the Mediterranean region, we may be sure that the prophet's words apply even more so to the far-flung British Empire. In the heart of the vast seas are your territories. Also, Ezekiel 27:15 accurately describes the British maritime system, saying of it, "Many islands were merchants in your employ." Ezekiel appropriately likens the city of Tyre to a ship, what might be called a ship of state. Ezekiel 27:5-6 says, "Out of juniper timbers from Senir, they built for you all the planks. A cedar from Lebanon they took to make a mast for you. Out of the massive trees of Bashan, they made your oars. Your prow they made with ivory and cypress wood from the islands of Kittim." A sailing vessel is an appropriate symbol for the maritime power of the British Isles. Not only because she maintained her far-flung empire by means of an extensive navy and merchant marine, but also because Great Britain was once the world's leading shipbuilder, and not just of warships. At the time of the First World War, British-built merchant ships accounted for a staggering 60% of the tonnage of all the world's ships. And because the Royal Navy once dominated, being larger than the combined navies of the next two contenders, London was able to control merchant shipping globally. Like her Tyrian forerunner, London is aptly likened to a sailing vessel manned by skilled sailors and craftsmen from many lands. That is because Canada, Australia, New Zealand, India, and many other territories in the imperial realm have made significant contributions to the upkeep of the British Empire, especially during times of war. Hence, Ezekiel 27:8-10 is relevant for Tyre's modern incarnation as the British Empire. "The inhabitants of Sidon and Arvad themselves were your rowers for you. Your skilled ones, O Tyre, happened to be in you. They were your sailors, Even old men of Gebal and her skilled ones happen to be in you as caulkers for your seams. All the ships of the sea and their mariners themselves prove to be in you in order to exchange articles of merchandise. Persians and Ludum and men of Put, they happen to be in your military force, your men of war. Shield and helmet they hung up in you. They were the ones that caused your splendor. However, one difficulty that must be overcome for the Bible student concerning the parallel between ancient Tyre and the British Empire is the fact that Great Britain no longer has such a far-reaching, static naval presence. But one of the reasons is that nuclear submarines have reduced the need for land-based control of strategic choke points, of which the United Kingdom maintains a fleet based at Faslane, Scotland. As in the case with its American military partner, at least one of Her Majesty's submarines is prowling beneath the oceans of the earth at any given moment, armed with the most lethal weapons ever devised. Although Great Britain no longer controls maritime commerce to the extent that she did during her glory years, nevertheless, London still dominates the world in significant ways. Contrary to popular myths, the power of the British Empire acquired during the past 300 years has not significantly diminished. London has merely transformed itself into a financial empire, while the United Kingdom itself remains part of the most powerful alliance on earth, the Anglo-American Dyad. Subheading: The Tradeswoman for the Peoples. London certainly fits the description of being the tradeswoman of many lands. In times past, the privately owned British East India Company and the British Merchant Marine and Navy brought in the booty from the far reaches of the empire. While the East India Company no longer exists, many of the world's largest corporations today began years ago as part of London's global trading enterprise. For example, the Bank of England, founded in 1694, is one of the oldest commercial institutions in existence and sits at the center of London's mercantile and financial system. Names like Barclays and the recently defunct Barings Bank are associated with the empire of yesteryear. HSBC, otherwise known as the Hong Kong and Shanghai Banking Corporation, was founded in 1865 in order to process the money taken from selling opium to the Chinese peasantry. Headquartered in London, HSBC is now one of the largest financial institutions on the planet, touting itself as the world's local bank. De Beers has a virtual monopoly over diamond production in Africa and was a key component of the empire. Lloyd's of London is the oldest and largest insurer in the world. Wall Street's J.P. Morgan & Company has an Anglo pedigree that extends back to 1838. GlaxoSmithKline originated as a drugstore in London nearly 300 years ago and has grown into the fourth largest pharmaceutical company in the world. These are just a few well-known companies that have roots that reach back to the heyday of Queen Victoria's British Empire and that still presently control vast riches on a global scale. In the modern era, companies associated with the British Empire dominate raw materials and precious metals mining. Companies like Anglo Gold, Ashanti, Lowmin, formerly Low Row, short for London, Rhodesia, Anglo-American PLC, and the British Australian companies Rio Tinto Zinc and BHP Billiton are recognized as key components to London's domination of precious metals and raw materials production globally. But London's dominance of the raw materials production is enhanced through trading mere contracts for such materials. As an example of the global reach of the City of London's financial district, until just recently, the international price of gold was fixed twice a day at exactly 10:30 a.m. and 3 p.m. by the office of London's N.M. Rothschild. Furthermore, until recently, futures contracts controlling more than two-thirds of the world's oil were traded on the floor of London's International Petroleum Exchange. It has been estimated that once an oil tanker leaves the Persian Gulf, its cargo may be bought and sold 100 times in the virtual oil markets before ever it reaches its final destination. And because international oil sales are denominated in U.S. dollars, London exerts tremendous control over the value of the so-called petrodollar. Also, the London Metal Exchange is the world's leading trader in non-ferrous metals. On a busy day, the LME may facilitate contracts worth more than $10 billion. While England itself has no raw materials except coal, as of 1997, British and Commonwealth allied firms controlled 60% of the world's annual gold production, amounting to a stake of nearly $15 billion. Furthermore, London-centered groups control fully one-half of all diamond production, 25% of the world's copper, 29% of silver production, and 78% of the mining of the precious metal platinum. Today, London's share is even greater than it was in 1997. Like Tyre, London has also amassed silver and gold in great quantity. The scripture says, "And Tyre proceeded to build a rampart for herself and to pile up silver like dust and gold like the mire of the streets." The ancient prophecy pertaining to Tyre's many trading partners and the numerous articles of exchange that were traded finds an amazing correspondency with the global reach of the city of London. For instance, the 12th verse reads, "Tarshish was your merchant because of the abundance of all sorts of valuable things, for its silver, iron, tin, and lead, your stores were given." The 22nd verse continues, "The traders of Sheba and Rama themselves were your traders, for the finest of all sorts of perfumes and precious stones and gold, your stores were given." In addition to mining, British Petroleum and Dutch Royal Shell are the Crown's flagship oil companies that trade in that precious commodity. And since all international oil contracts are denominated in what are called petrodollars, currency traders and hedge funds control the value of the U.S. dollar. And undoubtedly, ever since the industrial age created an insatiable thirst for petroleum, Anglo-American interests have exerted a strong controlling hand in the affairs of the oil-rich Middle East. Besides controlling much of the Earth's raw materials, a handful of companies hold sway over the most important commodity of all, food. Unilever, for example, headquartered in London and Rotterdam, is one of the oldest and largest food production companies in the world. The interlocking British, Dutch, and Swiss companies are the world's leading merchants in food commodities and constitute a cartel by virtue of owning controlling interest in several giant food processing companies. And just as with metals and petroleum, food commodities contracts are a substantial part of the trading strategies of London's hedge fund managers and brokers. According to Isaiah's prophecy against Sidon, the merchants of Tyre and Sidon enriched themselves off of the harvest of the nations. Isaiah 23:3 says, "And on many waters has been the seed of Sihor, the harvest of the Nile, her revenue, and it came to be the profit of the nations." How true that has been for the traders located in the modern Tyre as well. The British system has become the model for the present global financial system and is designed to extract the wealth of nations, and the prophecies definitely seem to speak to that very reality. Tyre was not even a nation in and of itself, but it was merely an island city on the Phoenician coast, even as Isaiah 23:7 acknowledges, saying, "Is this your city that was exultant from days of long ago, from her early times? Her fleet used to bring her far away to reside as an alien. In the same way, London surpasses the importance of even the nations of the United Kingdom. For that matter, metropolitan London is not even the real London. The 1 mile square financial district in the heart of London, called the City of London, or sometimes simply the City, is the actual nexus of today's global financial system. The city even has its own mayor, who carries the title of the Right Honorable Lord Mayor of the City of London. Due to the rapid growth of the financial industry in recent years, the City of London has spilled over into Canary Wharf. Whereas in the past, commerce between peoples and nations depended upon either overland trade routes or navigating the seas and waterways, today, much of what passes for economic trade has very little to do with the actual exchange of goods, but is merely what is called financial turnover. Because of structural changes in the global monetary system, money itself has become the most bought and sold commodity, and it is exchanged electronically around the world 24 hours a day. In times past, some tangible asset backed a nation's currency, usually gold and silver. More recently, particularly since 1971, the gold standard was scrapped, and a so-called floating exchange rate was adopted, which allows the world's various currencies to float in their value relative to each other. The present financial system has allowed modern money changers to make enormous profits, selling one currency and buying another, as the floating exchange rate of each currency ebbs and flows on a daily basis, like the lunar-driven tides. The relevance of this, as it relates to the Tyre on the Thames, is that London dominates today's global financial system, which it has invented to replace the mercantile system Britannia used to monopolize. According to the latest statistics from the Bank of International Settlements, on any given day, approximately $3 trillion are exchanged from one currency to the next. Of that enormous sum, less than 0.5% is actually exchanged in purchase of something. That means that over 99% of the $3 trillion daily financial turnover buys absolutely nothing except more money. But because such enormous amounts of money are involved, even slight fluctuations in the relative values of each nation's currency, amounting to mere fractions of pennies, can add up to millions or even billions of dollars of profit per exchange. The banking houses of London control the lion's share of the lucrative forex, foreign exchange markets, along with sizable shares of all other so-called hot money speculative schemes, including derivatives. Some estimates say that London controls anywhere from 35% to 50% of the daily global financial turnover. Besides being the center of currency trading and all sorts of derivatives, the British Bankers Association fixes the daily LIBOR, London Interbank Offered Rate. LIBOR determines the wholesale cost of borrowing money for banks and major borrowers around the world. Unquestionably, the London-dominated financial system wields more power than even national governments. Whereas London used to be the tradeswoman for many peoples through domination of the seas, today, even greater control of the world's business and financial affairs is exercised through London's domination of the electronic floating exchange rate system and the associate banking and equity markets. And that way, London still sits at the heart of an informal empire. How true Ezekiel's words in the 33rd verse, "When your stores went forth from the open sea, you satisfied many peoples. With the abundance of your valuable things and your articles of exchange, you made earth's kings rich." Subheading: The Bestower of Crowns, Whose Merchants Were Princes. Isaiah 23:8 poses the question, who is it that has given counsel against Tyre, the bestower of crowns, whose merchants were princes, whose tradesmen were the honorable ones of the earth? The next verse answers, Jehovah of armies himself has given this counsel to profane the pride of all beauty, to treat with contempt all the honorable ones of earth. To Jehovah, a timeless being in a realm far above the comings and goings of our minuscule planet, there is no such thing as yesterday and tomorrow. What from our standpoint appears to be the future, to God is as yesterday. That is why Jehovah knows the future, because he has already been there, so to speak. So while Jehovah's word was written down thousands of years ago and originally applied to primitive nations and peoples, the patterns established in Scripture, due to Jehovah's unfathomable insight and foresight, make God's counsel relevant for the judgment to come. No wonder the apostle once exclaimed, "Oh, the depth of God's riches and wisdom and knowledge! How unsearchable his judgments are, and past tracing out his ways are." As for the counsel of Jehovah against Tyre, this aspect of prophecy seems to apply to London in greater measure. Just a brief glance at the history and origin of many contemporary nations reveals that London is indeed the bestower of crowns. The following is a partial list of a few nations that were originally established in their modern form by the crown. Zimbabwe, Botswana, Malawi, Malaysia, India, Egypt, Sudan, and Aden. Nations such as Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Kuwait, Qatar, Kashmir, United Arab Emirates, and Iran exist in their modern form as a legacy of British imperialism. After the First World War, the victorious Great Britain received from the newly formed League of Nations, which London was instrumental in creating, what is referred to as the British Mandate. The mandate was for Great Britain to administer the region of the Middle East, which had formerly been part of the Ottoman Empire. This led to the eventual establishment of the modern state of Israel in 1948. But long before their mandate, London had quite literally redrawn the map of a large geographical area of the world. The success of the British Empire in dominating such a vast area of the world was due in part to the fact that the British were excellent administrators, and they set up domestic kings and governors, satraps, to rule under the British crown. By establishing subservient governments, the empire alleviated the need to continually subjugate people by the edge of the sword. And even as the formal empire was dissolved, numerous nations have stayed under the crown as members of the so-called British Commonwealth and other dependent territories. Up to the present time, 54 nations are part of the British Commonwealth. There are 16 nations that still have the Queen of England as their sovereign, although each now has a great measure of autonomy. Besides the nations of the United Kingdom itself, the most prominent members of the Commonwealth are Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. Through the Queen's Privy Council, London's political power is extended over all the nations in the royal realm. Besides being the bestower of crowns, the scripture says that Tyre's merchants were princes, whose tradesmen were the honorable ones of the earth. True to the pattern of her Tyrian forerunner, many of the most honored men and women in the world today are dukes and duchesses, lords and ladies, barons and baronesses of British peerage. The monarchy itself is known as the font of honor and the source of all dignities. Although a relic of the feudal system, British knighthood is a coveted honor today. Many members of the British House of Lords sit on company boards as directors of some of the most powerful corporations in the world. Others who are not born into British nobility and hence not considered peers of the aristocracy may, nonetheless, also receive an honorary knighthood from the Queen. It is not at all uncommon to find names prefaced with Sir listed as CEOs and other high-ranking corporate executives. While perhaps not princes in the traditional sense, such men are nonetheless wealthy merchants and tradesmen who are indeed the honorable ones of the earth under the present Anglo-aristocratic system. Some well-known American businessmen and political leaders have even attained honorary knighthood in the British honors system. For instance, George Bush Sr., Henry Kissinger, Colin Powell, Ronald Reagan, Brent Scowcroft, and the late Ken Lay of Enron infamy, carry the honorary title of Sir. More recently, the name most associated with the British system of free trade and usury, and some say the one most responsible for the financial collapse now rocking America, Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan was knighted by the Queen, presumably for services rendered to the crown. Subheading: Because of the injustice of your sales goods. As the anointed cherub that is covering, obviously Satan the devil is not directly involved in commerce. Yet Ezekiel prophesied against the king of Tyre, saying, "Because of the abundance of your sales goods, they filled the midst of you with violence, and you began to sin. Owing to the abundance of your errors, because of the injustice of your sales goods, you have profaned your sanctuaries." Without question, London is one of, if not the most important, commercial centers in the world. But in what way has modern commerce contributed to violence and injustice? Ezekiel 28:3 says of the king of Tyre, "Look, you're wiser than Daniel. There are no secrets that have proved a match for you. By your wisdom and by your discernment, you have made wealth for yourself, and you keep getting gold and silver in your storehouse." According to the Bible writer James, the wisdom of this world is earthly, animal, and demonic. Because the king of Tyre is said to have acquired gold and silver by his great wisdom, it can only be the sort of animalistic wisdom of this world. His being wiser than Daniel might suggest that the satanic king of Tyre understands the hidden meanings of prophecies, and he attempts to change the times and law established in the Word of God. But besides the control London has exerted over the world's raw materials and credit creation, and the many wars that have been fought in the last 200 years due to British geopolitical machinations, history shows that London's insatiable desire for global domination has led her to shamelessly exploit mankind's many vices and weaknesses in order to control her subjects and make them more pliable and submissive. Just as a cunning predator can sense the weakness of its intended prey, in the same manner, the empire has made it their aim to exploit and cater to debased human inclinations and ignorance. Like their imperial Roman predecessors used the bread and circuses approach to placate and demoralize the masses, so too London has promoted destructive sales goods. How have they done this? From the earliest times of colonization, London is trafficked in tobacco and dope. In fact, tobacco once served as currency for English settlers in the New World. Great Britain, for the most part, invented the tobacco industry, and to this day, British-owned tobacco companies are among the world's largest producers of the noxious weed. For instance, the British American Tobacco Company was formed over 100 years ago for the purpose of promoting and profiting from tobacco throughout the entire world, and is in fact the largest international tobacco company. And although now headquartered in New York City, the giant cigarette company Philip Morris began as a tobacco shop on Oxford Street in London. It is also well documented that London established the illicit drug trade, and the merchant banks of London have reaped enormous profits, pushing dope on the peoples of lesser nations. Back during the 1800s, British plantations in India grew the narcotic-producing poppy that was processed into opium, which was then imported by British merchants into China. The former British colony of Hong Kong was originally an offshore staging area for the importation of dope into mainland China. When Chinese rulers resisted the destruction of their people by the Lords of London and moved to stop the destructive drug trade, the British Navy responded with gunboats in what became known as the Opium Wars. The London-centered empire of the financiers is best described as a vast criminal enterprise with tentacles that embrace the entire globe. To illustrate the criminal nature of the empire, in modern times, it has been documented that the driving force behind the illegal drug industry does not originate in the jungles of Colombia or in the poppy-strewn hillsides of Turkey or Afghanistan or elsewhere where peasants cultivate dope. The real beneficiaries and primary promoters of the lucrative drug trade are not the street pushers or even the notorious drug lords. What is seldom mentioned, but no less true, is that without the money laundering services of the banking system, the drug trade would soon choke on its own flood of cash. Hence, the laundering of drug money is a vital necessity, and that is where the global financial system comes in. The $1 trillion per year drug trade nets the banks and hedge funds involved hundreds of billions of dollars. Without question, dope still is one of the most important sales goods of the British Empire. As previously mentioned, British islands such as the Caymans, Bahamas, Antigua, and the Antilles are well known for their so-called offshore money laundering and tax-evading banking schemes. The fact that they are offshore takes them out of reach of the only authorities that are powerful enough to do anything to stop their illegal transactions. In other ways, the British Empire, along with her compliant American partner, merchandise in violence by being the foremost exporters of weapons of all kinds. Furthermore, the Anglo-American entertainment industry has obviously set out to intentionally pervert and demoralize entire populations. The Western form of debasing music and immoral and violent entertainment is produced and distributed around the world through Anglo-dominated media channels. Related to the merchandising of corruption and violence, Ezekiel says of Tyre, "O praised city, who became a strong one in the sea, she and those inhabiting her, those who gave their terror to all the inhabitants of the earth." If you were to ask the so-called man on the street what nation he thought was most responsible for promoting international terrorism, more than likely the respondent would say Iraq, Iran, or perhaps some Asian nation. However, London itself is known as the preferred haven of terrorists. As recently as 2001, London was rocked by the charge of harboring terrorists. The London Guardian reported that Egypt's president officially protested that London provides sanctuary for international Islamic terrorists. Many terrorist organizations even have headquarters in London itself. These have included some of the most notorious terrorist groups known, such as the Tamil Tigers of Sri Lanka and the Shining Path of Peru. In November 2001, the USA Today carried an article exposing how numerous Islamic groups, including Al-Qaeda, find sanctuary in London. In recent years, whistleblowers from inside MI5 and MI6 have detailed how British intelligence goes about recruiting Islamic radicals, who are then injected into larger terrorist groups, which can then be controlled from London and used for false flag operations, assassinations, and so forth. A case in point, it has long been known that even Osama bin Laden and the Islamic Mujahideen were originally created and controlled by British and American intelligence during the Soviet-Afghan War. There's really no reason to assume that that connection has ever been severed. Bin Laden even applied for asylum in Britain as recently as 1995. Of course, Osama bin Laden is considered to be the sole mastermind of the most devastating terror attack in history, the so-called 9/11 Twin Towers and Pentagon attack. However, it is typical that whenever a highly orchestrated attack such as 9/11 or a high-level political assassination is carried out, patsies are always conveniently in place beforehand, who are then fingered as the sole perpetrators of the crime. And naturally, such lone culprits are usually never brought to justice for fear their court testimony might reveal the real truth. In the case of 9/11, however, recent revelations established a London-Saudi connection through the British defense company BAE. It turns out that billions of dollars in a complex oil-for-arms deal ultimately funneled money from a Saudi prince to the Saudi hijackers while they were in flight class in America. But should anything less be expected from the town on the Thames that serves as the modern throne of Satan the devil? Another form of terror and thievery emanates from London as well. Piracy. As this second edition goes to print, an article appearing in the London Guardian of May 11, 2009, reports that Somali pirates involved in the recent rash of ship hijackings are being guided to their targets via satellite telephone by a consultant team within British intelligence in the praised city of London. Captains of hijacked ships have reported that the pirates know everything about the ship's cargo, such as which flag they fly under, their destinations, the layout of the ship, etc., before ever the pirates board the vessel. Such knowledge would be impossible for the ragtag team of impoverished Somalis to attain without the help from insiders. Predictably, no sooner had the Guardian article hit the press, the official line from London was that the pirate operation was the work of a sole renegade agent. Truly, though, reality confirms what the scriptures long ago foretold. The modern King of Tyre is the brain center for the manifold forms of terror that threaten the nations today. Great Britain long ago earned the name of Perfidious Albion, which means treacherous England, because she became very adept in the ways of treachery in order to win the great game of international geopolitics. In order to stay on top of the heap, it has always been the policy of the empire to set peoples and nations against each other in order to further its own interests. Divide and conquer is a time-tested and effective strategy. Should it really be surprising that the earthly place of Satan's throne should use terrorism to further its own ends, even against its closest allies, if necessary? While America may provide the brawn, London provides the brains of the Anglo-American special relationship. In order to weaken the independent nation-states, through its network of operatives, the London-centered oligarchy has deployed various terrorist groups, so as to create tensions and destabilizations throughout the world. To what extent the Tyre on the Thames may yet give their terror to all the inhabitants of the earth remains to be seen. At any rate, Jehovah's judgment against the devil applies to his earthly agents as well. Your heart became haughty because of your beauty. You brought your wisdom to ruin on account of your beaming splendor. Subheading: Sudden Terrors Are What I Shall Make You. Ezekiel 26:21 says, "Sudden terrors are what I shall make you, and you will not be, and you will be sought for, but you will no more be found to time indefinite. But in what way could ancient Tyre have possibly experienced sudden terrors? There was nothing sudden about the downfall of Tyre. In reality, Nebuchadnezzar waged a grueling and laborious 13-year siege against the city. At Ezekiel 29:18-20, Jehovah acknowledges that Nebuchadnezzar performed a service in behalf of God against Tyre, but he received little compensation for his efforts. For that reason, Jehovah said he would give Egypt to the king of Babylon as compensation for Tyre. Significantly, even though Tyre fell many years before Egypt, the prophet Isaiah makes no distinction between the two, and in fact seems to suggest that Egypt falls first, which historically was not the case. Isaiah 23:5 says, "Just as at the report pertaining to Egypt, people will likewise be in severe pains at the report on Tyre." The seeming discrepancy in the prophecies is better understood in light of the fact that the real fulfillment has to do with the simultaneous fall of the Anglo-American dyad. Jesus Christ foretold that the day of Jehovah will erupt suddenly, and that it will come in upon all those dwelling upon the face of all the earth, so that men become faint out of fear and expectation of the things coming upon the inhabited earth, for the powers of the heavens will be shaken. The present-day preeminent powers of the heavens are the Anglo-American kings. The shaking of the powers of the heavens is something entirely unanticipated and unique. That is why Ezekiel 26:15-16 goes on to prophesy against Tyre. "At the sound of your downfall, when the fatally wounded one groans, when there is a killing with slaughter in the midst of you, will not the islands rock? And down from their thrones all the chieftains of the sea will certainly come and remove their sleeveless coats, and they will strip off their own embroidered garments. They will put on trembling spells. Upon the earth they will sit down, and they will certainly tremble every moment and stare in amazement at you." The 12th chapter of Revelation indicates the order of events when Christ assumes power in his kingdom. First, Satan and all his demons are ousted from heaven and confined to the vicinity of the earth in preparation for the final decisive battle. Because Satan is the god of this world, the judgment against him will have profound, far-reaching repercussions down upon the world under his influence. The death stroke leveled against the Anglo-American seventh head of the wild beast is actually the indirect result of the judgment against the symbolic seven-headed dragon, which represents the devil. In reality, the earthly seven-headed wild beast is a mere reflection of the seven-headed heavenly dragon. That is evident by reason of the fact that both the ouster of Satan and the death stroke of the beast initiate the aforementioned 3.5-year period of intense persecution of the holy ones. When Christ ultimately casts the devil down to the earth, the entire system will convulse with shudders of death. The fall of the Anglo-American king will mark the beginning of the end for Satan's entire wicked system of things, a time of tribulation that has no equal. The kings of the earth will come down off their thrones in the catastrophic fall of Egypt and Tyre, which will signal the end of the nation-state system and lead to the implementation of a totalitarian world government as the final gathering of the nations for Armageddon. The 17th and 18th chapters of Revelation confirm that the kings of the earth will forfeit their own power and authority to an eighth king whom they greatly fear. In harmony with that judgment, Ezekiel 28:8-9 says to the king of Tyre, "Down to the pit they will bring you, and you must die the death of someone slain in the heart of the open sea. Will you without fail say, I am a god, before the one killing you? Whereas you are a mere earthling man, and not a god, in the hand of those profaning you. For over 2 centuries, the British crown has dominated the world. First, through the exploitive seafaring mercantile system, and more recently through the sophisticated global financial system. And less overtly, but just as effectively, the empire has set about to undermine, weaken, and impoverish the nations through a variety of means, such as terrorism, flooding the world with dope, assassinations and threat of assassination of political figures, financial chicanery through mafia-like financial and commodities cartels, and so forth. Unquestionably, with its ruling monarchy and a circle of ultra-wealthy European oligarchs making up what is called the Club of the Isles, assisted by secondary tiers of Anglophile lackeys around the world, London is the operational nexus of a vast criminal enterprise and the most influential power center on Earth. London is the location of Satan's earthly throne. But when Jehovah himself becomes king, and his judgments are executed against the gods of this world, both human and otherwise, then down the godlike king of Tyre will come off his throne. Ezekiel 28:16-17 issues God's judgment against the devil and his human counterpart. Because of the abundance of your sales goods, they filled the midst of you with violence, and you began to sin. And I shall put you as profane out of the mountain of God, and I shall destroy you, O cherub that is covering, from the midst of the fiery stones. Your heart became haughty because of your beauty. You brought your own wisdom to ruin on account of your beaming splendor. Onto the earth I will throw you. Before kings I will set you, for them to look upon you. In view of the obvious similarities between the King of Tyre and the modern London-centered British Empire, it is evident that Jehovah's judgment against the covering cherub of Tyre is in reality describing Satan's eventual ouster from heaven. The prophets indicate that the visible manifestation of the satanic cherub being thrown down onto the earth will be the sudden and horrifying downfall of the Anglo-American dyad. A correct interpretation of the relevant apocalyptic prophecies completely debunks the notion that Satan was cast down from heaven in 1914 and that the Anglo-American kingdom suffered its apocalyptic sword stroke during the First World War. That is evident from the fact that the casting down of the covering cherub results in complete destruction for the powers that be. The last verse of Ezekiel's denunciation of the King of Tyre says, "As for all those knowing you among the peoples, they will certainly stare in amazement at you. Sudden terrors are what you must become, and you will be no more to time indefinite."